Welcome to the Azure Security Podcast, where we discuss topics relating to security, privacy, reliability, and compliance on the Microsoft Cloud Platform.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 117. This week is myself, Michael, with Sarah. Everyone else is busy. And our guest this week is Russ Rogers, who's here to talk to us about a topic we have never discussed, which is gaming security. But before we get to our guest, let's take a little lap around the news. By the way, we have a lot of news this week. Sarah, so why don't you kick things off?
Lots of AKS stuff. So let's run through it. So Azure Bastion will now connect to a private AKS cluster. So if you need to do that, it's a nice way of connecting securely. I would call it a jump box, but it's all managed by Microsoft if you haven't used Azure Bastion. Confidential VMs for Ubuntu 24.04 are now also available in AKS. So if you want to use a confidential compute, you can do that with your Ubuntu. We've also got deployment safeguards are now GA in AKS, so they are helping enforce particular configurations, which get rid of potential security issues and non-compliant things. You can do them in warning or you can do enforcement. So again, some nice safeguards to reduce bugs and misconfigurations. And we know that can be bad for your security. Also, we've got application gateways for containers, which is one, which is now in public preview. Now, we've talked about WAF before. You should, if you're running a web application in your containers, you should be using a web application firewall. So go do the thing. And obviously the thing at the moment, we've got in public preview, the AKS MCP server. So that means that you can use the AKS MCP server to advertise your cluster as a tool. So go and do that if you are wanting to have your LLMs access AKS. But as we talked about a few episodes ago, obviously there are security considerations to take into account. So definitely have a think before you do that. AKS has now got a security dashboard, which is super exciting. That means that you can actually have a look at your security posture across your whole cluster, which is nice for visibility. And then last but not least, for all the product things, we have the app service is now supporting inbound IP version 6 support. So if you're eventually everyone's going to have to do IP version 6. So get ahead of things and go have a look at that. So I'll take a breath for a second. And that is all our product stuff. But also, we've mentioned this before, we've been releasing our developer security questions that we recorded at Build a few months ago. And there's a couple we put in the show notes to highlight. We did keys or tokens, and we asked everyone what they would prefer to use. And that got a lot of views so far. And also, what's your worst security coding mistake? And what's the best advice you received as about securing coding securely? Now, that's my personal favorite one. I won't give it away why it's my personal favorite, but it's the answer from David Fowler, which was hilarious. And I know a lot of people have asked you, Michael, I think. This was not rehearsed, just to say again.
Yeah, 100%. It was great, the fact that they were not rehearsed. The responses were absolutely gorgeous. They really, really were. Actually, I have a ton of news as well. First one is CoQL support for Rust is now in public preview. This is huge. CoQL is one of my favorite tools. It is a static analysis platform. It's been around for a while, supporting C, C++, C#, JavaScript, Python, and a few other languages. But we now have support in public preview for Rust as well. The nice thing about CoQL is you can write your own little rules. You don't have to pay someone, you know, $50,000 to write a bunch of rules. You can actually go ahead and write your own. Next, ASP.NET Core now supports passkeys. Big fan of passkeys because the credential is maintained in some hardware device or on your laptop or whatever. So it's great to see the support now being added to ASP.NET Core. Key thing with passkeys is that they are phishing resistant. Next is in public preview is Roslyn Analyzer for Durable Functions in .NET Isolated is available. Okay, quick history lesson. Back in the day, the managed code tool chain, so C#, VB.NET and all those other tools were rewritten, and the project name was Roslyn. A key part of Roslyn is the ability to add your own analysis tools or use off-the-shelf analysis tools that plug into the environment. It's not the same as CoQL, it's quite different. But at the various stages of the compilation process, like all the lexical analysis, all the syntax parsing, all the code generation, all that sort of optimization, all that sort of stuff, you can actually add your own code in that process to do your own analysis. I don't believe that's the case here, but you can certainly put your own coding constraints by using Roslyn. So this is great to see. I'm a huge fan of anything that makes detection of issues early is a good thing. Next thing in private preview, we have confidential VMs now support Intel TDX. If you're familiar with SGX, this is now that's now been replaced by Trust Domain Extensions or TDX from Intel. So those VM series of confidential VMs is DC ESV6 and EC ESV6. Next, from my own stomping ground in Azure Data, in public preview, Azure Cosmos DB from MongoDB now supports encryption with customer managed keys. So there's a billion times, I'll say it again, it's great to see key support being given to the customers if they opt in to use it. You don't have to, you can obviously use system managed keys, but do be aware that, hey, you know, the keys are yours, and if you lose them, we don't have a copy of them. So make sure you do appropriate backups of keys. Next is, and this is a bit of a mouthful, but it's generally available, Private Application Gateway is now available on Azure Application Gateway version 2. A keyword there is Private Application Gateway. It gives you things like a private IP-only front-end configuration, enhanced control over network security groups, and things like control over route table rules and forced tunneling support. Great to see. Anything that provides extra layers of network isolation, I'm a big fan of. Back to confidential VMs in public preview. We now have confidential VMs for Azure Linux. That is the essentially the Microsoft distribution of Linux. So great to see that as well. Generally available is the network security perimeter support. This allows organizations to define a logical network isolation boundary for PaaS services. So for example, Azure storage accounts or Azure SQL databases. This is, again, it's another way of defining an isolation technique. In this case, it's obviously the network layer. But you can do things like provide private access to various resources within the network environment, within the network security perimeter, without exposing them publicly. Another one which is developer related, even though the CoQL one was developer related, safeguarding VS Code against prompt injections. There's a blog post up on GitHub. Long story short, if you're using VS Code and you're using any of the AI agents that are built into or have access to within Visual Studio Code, you need to go ahead and read this blog post. An old colleague of mine, Simone Curtsy, has produced a tool called QRisk Tree Editor. If you're really confused about how to bridge the gap between threats and organizational risk, this is a really cool tool. I'm kind of sad that Mark isn't here because he would be really ecstatic about this. Okay, second to last item, I promise. I was interviewed by the fine folks at .NET Rocks. The title of the episode, which by the way is episode 1963, which is insane. It was entitled 30 Years of Application Security. And basically we just have a good old chat about, the history of application security, how far we've come, things that are still of concern, so on and so forth. Very laid back conversation. And the last one, and I just threw this in just out of interest, it sort of passed my desk this morning. The first known AI-powered ransomware has been detected in the wild. And if you want my opinion, this is just the start. So I'll provide a link to that. I haven't dug into it in any great detail. So, take it with a pinch of salt, but I don't doubt these guys are telling the truth. All right, so now that we've got the news out of the way, I think it's actually the longest news section we ever had. Anyway, so as I mentioned at the top of the hour, our guest this week is Russ Rogers, who is here from the Xbox team to talk about gaming security. So Russ, thank you so much for joining us this week. Would you like to take a moment and introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's an honor. I am an old school hacker. I've done penetration testing, red team, exploit dev, that kind of stuff for many, many years, over 25 years at this point. I was chief of operations for DEF CON when I retired after 20 years, and That was a while ago. Now I went to work at Xbox. I actually went back and got a second bachelor's degree in game programming because I wanted to solve some big data problems with security tools like EDR, that kind of stuff, making the data more intuitive. And it ended up landing me a job over in Xbox. So I'm coming up on, I don't know, 4 or 5 years over here now. And that's basically what I do. It's kind of a dream job for me. I always wanted to work in the gaming industry. I never assumed as a kid that it would be working in security, but yeah. So that's where I'm at now. I work in gaming security as the new org. Love what I do. It's a good time. It really is.
So before we get stuck into this, I want to sort of bridge the gap between Azure and gaming. Again, it's a topic that we've never discussed on this podcast at all. But at the end of the day, you know, many games are, especially multiplayer games, are hosted on cloud infrastructure, including Azure. There's many games that you know and love that are also hosted on Azure. But it extends beyond that, right? Because a lot of assets in games, even single-player games, are stored, air quotes, in the cloud. So that way you can hop from device to device or, you know, whatever. But the key point is that the cloud plays a really important role in gaming, and cloud security obviously plays a key role there as well. So I thought I'd just give some, like, why are you guys actually covering gaming security? Well, that's the exact reason why. So before we get stuck into the questions and the sort of commentary, so just so everyone knows, the three of us spoke a few days ago about some topics we want to talk about, and we came up with a list. So we're going to go through that list, and it'll be hopefully very conversational. So the first thing I really want to point out, which I've, you know, sort of already touched on, is we've never done gaming before. My background back in the day, I actually worked on the Xbox 360 security on many of the defenses that go into that product, both at the hardware level and at the software level. Fun fact, the first version of Windows to actually have a hypervisor was actually Windows, a variant of Windows running on the Xbox 360. Not a lot of people know that, but hey, there you go. All right, so let's get into stuff, into a series of comments that we talked about a couple of days ago.
Okay, so Russ, there are so many things I could ask you about, well, gaming in general, but we'll stick with security. So what are the main things that you have to work on and secure? The software, the services, the client machines that obviously are running things? Tell me more.
Well, that's a great question. The landscape here is growing. Xbox is evolving. The whole concept of gaming for everyone and Phil Spencer's mission of providing gaming on any platform where there are players that want to play our games, it's really kind of expanded the attack surface. And one of the things I thought Michael said that was really interesting was the discussion on cloud. And cloud is critical to what we do in the gaming industry, particularly within Xbox. You know, even in situations where game services or games themselves are using assets or services in those clouds, there's intercommunication between the various clouds, right? So while we have a large footprint in Azure, as Michael kind of stated already, there's stuff in other clouds as well. And so we have to look at security across all the different cloud platforms, as well as, you know, on our clients. The software that gets loaded by players, whether that be a handheld, whether that's on a PC gaming computer like I use, a Steam Deck, a console, right? One of the Xbox, a Series S or Series X, or, you know, one of the older platforms. All of those things have to be taken into consideration. And as Michael also mentioned, you know, we do have a lot of multiplayer stuff. And those multiplayer games are connected via services that run out on the internet, probably in the cloud, right? And so there's a whole lot that happens there. And what it really boils down to is securing the software, right? The secure software development lifecycle, making sure we're running CodeQL, like Michael was talking about in the news, right? We eat our own dog food along those lines. We run these tools, we improve these tools, and, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do internally ends up being public because those tools become very useful.
It's funny you should bring up the software security thing. At the end of the day, a game is just software. And that means the software will have vulnerabilities. I mean, it's just a fact of life, unfortunately, but it is what it is. I remember back in the day, there was a vulnerability in a game. I can't remember the game exactly, but there was a memory corruption vulnerability loading a saved file. It obviously, it's in one of the older platforms. But yeah, once there was a memory corruption inside the game, then the bad guy could create a malformed save file. You would load that save file into memory. And your malicious code would potentially run inside the environment. It may be isolated because it's running inside, you know, a hypervisor controlled environment, but it doesn't matter, right? It's still the potential for serious damage. So yeah, at the end of the day, it's just software. That's all it really is. Which then leads to another interesting thing that always worries me from just looking at, you know, Microsoft software from a general industry software in general, but Microsoft specifically, is supply chain issues, dependencies, and so on. One thing that we track all the time is dependencies, right? In fact, there's a Dependabot ability on GitHub, right? So if one of your dependencies has a vulnerability, you will automatically get a message saying, hey, you know, you've got a problem, and it will even provide a fix for you, like to bump up to the next version. So do you guys have to worry about dependencies as well? I mean, is that part of the reason why perhaps sometimes an update to a game is available?
Absolutely. You know, there are public libraries that we use, functions that we need to use either in services or client side, and we track that stuff. There are entire programs inside of Microsoft that we use within Xbox as well, within gaming overall, where we track those dependencies, where we track the version numbers, we track when vulnerabilities or new CVEs come out for those libraries that we utilize. We very, very careful with that, right? And you'll find that these vulnerabilities get picked up by our teams very, very quickly, and the reaction time is usually a matter of hours. And those are things that we worry about. But, you know, I think it's important to state that's a very common vision for us across gaming. I know that all of the teams at all the studios, and it's also important here to point out that the development that occurs within gaming is not strictly for the clients and the services specific to a game title, but they're also tools that we build for ourselves to make our processes work better, our operational support, as you were. And so we look at the dependencies and the software development stuff and the supply chain where we're picking up libraries from entities that are not internal to Microsoft. We watch those very, very carefully to ensure that anything we're building is locked down, right? I mean, that's a core process. And you see that coming out from NIST and CISA and some of these other United States-based regulation and standard organizations where they're creating these software bill of material requirements, right? This SBOM is what we call them. And that's basically an enumeration of all the libraries and all the software that we've included in a particular software product by version number so that we can track this more easily. And we can tell if something pops up, we know pretty quickly exactly which titles or clients or tools that impacts.
So one of the things I wanted to ask about is leaderboards. So I've heard that it is something that sometimes people do. I mean, we used to do it offline back in the day, right? How about like tampering with leaderboards? Is that actually something that, because that's a risk that we wouldn't think of in the rest of enterprise security?
I think it's, you know, it's a really good example because it's one of those things where we get kind of locked into that corporate mindset of what security means. And I think it would be really easy if you weren't a gamer to lose sight of the frustration and the emotional attachment that players have to their progress and to their characters and to their gaming experience. And leaderboards are critical to that. I mean, they're just a huge part of it. And so I think it was probably a few years ago was the last time I saw an active leaderboard issue, and it was huge. I mean, the players were understandably upset, right? This isn't a situation where you get on and you play for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, or a cell phone game where, you know, you're standing in line at the bank or a restaurant for some pickup and you play a game for 12, 15 minutes. These are people that play and they devote their time to be it a racing game or a fighting game or whatever it is, right? They get on these leaderboards. And so when people are able to manipulate the backend services or the protocols, or maybe they manipulate the client side and the data that gets sent up to the leaderboards, and they get these impossible records that are on the leaderboard that can never, ever be beat by a human player, that's big, right? That's disheartening. It's frustrating. It's not just that you spent $40, $50, $60 on this game. It's that you've spent all these hours, weeks, months of your life playing these games. Like you said, Sarah, these games have been around. Some of these have been around for 10, 15 years, and these leaderboards are hugely important to the players. So it is something we track. It is something that when it pops up or we hear news of a potential leaderboard issue, we start investigating immediately, right? It's very, very important to us to make sure that the players are having a good time and that the environment is fair for everybody.
Okay, switching gears a little bit. So one thing that always worries me from a security standpoint is essentially backward compatibility, because sometimes there may be decisions that are made 20 years ago, 15 years ago, that may have been fine back then, but may not be the greatest thing today. Do you guys have issues like that with legacy games running on the platform, especially those that are multiplayer?
Yeah, we've had to change a lot of our focus on legacy games. You know, it's a big strategy for Phil Spencer and the rest of Xbox Gaming or Microsoft Gaming to ensure that we keep the legacy games that are still very popular with players around as long as we possibly can. And some of these games were built, 15, 20 years ago, completely different operating systems, completely different hardware, architectures, languages, libraries, right? The list is endless. And so it's a constant challenge for the studios to keep these games accessible in a manner that's secure, right? And you talk about using containers and stuff like that and using the cloud. All those things come into play, as well as making sure that we're really tracking those libraries we bring in, that supply chain that we already touched on. You've got to figure out how to keep those games accessible, right? How do we keep those in Game Pass? How do we keep players playing those and keep the leaderboard safe and keep the game functioning the way it was intended, but make sure it's secure, right? And those are very, very real considerations. I deal with that on a weekly basis with what I do at work. It's huge, right? It's very important to Microsoft Gaming to keep those titles available and accessible to players. But we have to do it intelligently. We have to do it securely. And we bounce our heads off of brick walls, like I said, on almost a weekly basis to try and create solutions that keep these games accessible. And the teams do a fantastic job at it, right? They're getting used to fighting these kind of wars to keep those games out there. So yeah, that's a really good point out. That's a huge issue.
My guess is, like, just if I take my security hat, if there's stuff that's really old that we don't trust, or or just stuff that could be potentially dangerous, or have insecure coding techniques because of it's written 15, 20 years ago, whatever, we would normally run something like that in a highly sort of virtualized or protected environment, some form of isolation environment. Essentially, if you look at zero trust, right, it's the whole, hey, let's just assume this game is going to blow up. So let's keep it isolated. So at least if it blows up in its own sandbox and doesn't start wrecking everything else around it. Is that something that the gaming industry does as well? Is we just tend to assume the worst, so isolate the game?
I think at this point it's dangerous. You've been doing security a long time too, right? I think it's dangerous to approach these kind of problem sets without assuming something's going to blow up. And so while we want to keep games accessible and we want as many players as we can, I think you have to contain those and you have to limit the collateral damage that could occur if something does get popped. If a vulnerability is discovered that you've known nothing about and it destroys that version of the game, we have to have a situation where we can roll back to a known good, patch the system, get the game back up, and it doesn't hurt the players. It doesn't impact their privacy. Worst case scenario, maybe they have, you know, a few hours of downtime, something like that. But yeah, you have to isolate it, right? That's really the only way to do it. You've got to limit the trust boundaries. There are considerations, right? And when it gets really challenging, you know, it leads to conversations about, well, is this one of those rare situations where we should consider sunsetting a title? And we try very hard not to do that, right? That's not our goal. Our goal is to keep as many games out there as we can. And so our perspectives kind of change about how we address this security problem. And isolation's a big part of that, right? Keep them inside a steel box, so if anything happens, you know, it's contained.
Yeah, a really good analogy, and then I'll hand over to Sarah. A really good analogy is an office, right? So if you open up a document that came from the internet, we run that in a thing called protected mode, which is an isolated boundary, wasn't referred to as a low integrity boundary. And because we assume that the document's vulnerable, you know, it contains some, we assume that there's a bug in Word, and we assume that the document is going to cause that vulnerability to, you know, it may not be a vulnerability we don't even know about. But again, you're just assuming that bad things are going to happen. So run the thing inside of a, as you put it, like an iron box. Well, I think iron box is possibly stretching things a little bit, but yeah, in a strong boundary. So if it blows up, the damage is contained. Yeah, 100%.
So kind of building on, well, I'm going back to my leaderboards and stuff. Russ, another thing that, of course, we don't think about in enterprise security, cheating. So I know that when I was a kid, when I was playing games, I used to know, and I'm aging myself, of course, like I knew all my cheat codes, and there were other devices you could use to cheat. But how does that factor into the work you do in Xbox land?
Yeah, I would point out that a lot of those cheat codes that you were using on the controllers and stuff were actually backdoors put in by devs. And so I would argue that, yeah, okay, that's kind of cheating, but they put those God codes in there for us to find and use. So it was kind of a more benign situation back then. You know, cheating in games, it's more or less on two different levels, right? There's a service level cheating, which for me is very serious, right? And then there's the client level cheating where, you know, you download a local game to your game PC or to your handheld, and it's just a single player, right? And I won't name any game titles, but the idea being you're just sitting there, you're enjoying your game by yourself. It's not a multiplayer instance. If you're cheating kind of in those situations, I feel like you're basically cheating yourself, right? You're losing the experience of the game as it was created by the developers. Now, that doesn't mean it's necessarily bad, right? Maybe you really enjoy doing that. I think we see a whole lot fewer of those backdoors that developers put into the games, you know, the up, up, left, right, A, B, A, B, whatever, right? And I think nowadays, if people are cheating at games, there's a high probability somebody's got, you know, IDA Pro or Ollie Debug or something like that, and they're trying to find the breakpoints and the skip points in the running code and memory and stuff like that, so that they can give themselves more resources, better armor, more grenades, increase their score, right? Anything that will give you a benefit, either locally or at the service level, right? My concern is if you do this at the service level in multiplayer games, you've kind of stepped past that gray area, because now you're impacting other players that are playing the game. And that's my concern, right? We've stepped outside that point where you're impacting just yourself, only yourself, and you're doing harm to other people that are trying to enjoy the game. And so it does happen. Some people cheat to try and gain value for themselves. There are trolls on the internet that try to cheat just to make other players miserable. That's a very sad situation, right? Because maybe they're not invested in the gaming community like I am, but I feel like that's, you know, that's not the path I would follow. But cheating does happen. We get reports of it. Luckily, we also have a very active gaming community. And so we get bug reports on various game titles, and we take them seriously. We hear it, we try and replicate it, we try and figure out what the cause is. There are conversations back and forth between the finder and the developers. You know, this is a big deal. We want the gaming experience to be enjoyable. If it's not enjoyable, why are you gaming? Right. And so we try and limit how much third parties can impact the players that are playing our games.
So back in the day, I remember I said that I'd done some work on the 360. So one of the stats I heard was that if you have 3% of the population of a game cheating, then people start leaving the game. I mean, obviously you need to actively pursue, you know, putting protections in place and also, you know, banning people if it's obvious that they're cheating. But yeah, 3%, just think about that. That's a tiny number. That means if you're in a 32-person lobby, one person is cheating, and that's going to ruin your game experience. Fun little fact, I may or may not have done a bunch of cheating when I was a little kid. The reason why I allegedly did it is because I was really interested in breaking the game. The same applied to copy protection back in the day. And 99 times out of 100, I didn't even play the game. Just the intellectual challenge of breaking the game and being able to give myself infinite hit points or, you know, whatever it was. Again, for single player games, the risk was too high if I was doing it for multiplayer games. For example, and again, I don't know the policies here, but my guess is that back in the day, for single player Diablo 2, I don't think anyone really cared that much, right? You were just making your necromancer or your paladin better, but you weren't affecting anybody else's game. But in Diablo 4, if you're cheating and doing multiplayer, then that's a whole nother ball of wax, right? Because now you're making someone else's game miserable. All right. So what else? Next big one. Distributed denial of service or denial of service in general. I mean, that's got to be a huge problem for cloud-based gaming platforms.
Yeah, that's big across most service orgs, right? And most gaming nowadays that's not mobile, we could say is going to be service-based, right? So denial of service, that's the quickest way to ruin fun for everybody playing the game, right? And that expands. That's not just a problem within Microsoft Gaming. That expands to, you know, all the big game companies that have huge titles. It's just, you know, it's a problem. But I think the thing that's probably most useful to point out here is the fact that in most cases, DDoS isn't solved strictly by good software development practices. Right now, we're talking about architecture, infrastructure, the networking, the protocols, the alerting, load balancing, right? There's so much involved here to keep game services active and kind of respond to that. There are entire companies out there on the internet, I'm sure you could name a few, that their entire business model is providing some level of DDoS protection, whether it's service DDoS, where we're hitting specific ports that we know, whether it's DNS DDoS, right? We're creating issues with DNS providers. It's such a big business for people who like to do bad things to good games. So DDoS is out there. It is something we track. It is responded to a little bit different than some of the other things that we've already talked about, right? Because the approaches to secure those things and lock them down are a little bit different. So it's a little bit more complex of a problem to solve. But it's out there, and it is something that we track. We don't hear about that as much as some of the other problems we've seen, but we definitely do hear about it.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, like you say, for at least network level denial of service, that's something you just leave to the platform. I mean, Azure has built into it, you know, Azure DDoS protection, which is great stuff. And what's interesting is, you know, that service, I can't remember the version of it, you know, you get access to engineers who are experts in distributed denial of service attacks, which, you know, you're probably not. You're a game developer. You're probably not that knowledgeable about network level distributed denial of service vulnerabilities. But that being said, there are things that you can do, you know, in your code that are good programming practices that mitigate certain classes of vulnerabilities as well. But again, for networking, yeah, absolutely, leave that to the experts.
So, Russ, I've got another question for you about things that the rest of us might not have to worry about in the rest of security. But what about, obviously, a lot of minors, kids, people under 18, use gaming platforms. So what are the concerns there?
Yeah, protecting minors is a huge goal, right? That's one of our top priorities. There are a lot of youth, right, that play our games. And so we need to protect their anonymity. We need to protect their experience. And there's a lot of risk here. And I hate to say it, I don't think that we have direct control over everything that happens there, because interactions with unknown human beings somewhere else, you don't know their intent, right? You can't judge somebody to be ethical and moral during these game interactions. And we have situations, and they get reported to us. And what we do is we try to find out where we can augment security to protect minors. So if you consider like a game, you know, children play Minecraft. Minecraft's one of the most popular games on the planet. But there are kids there. But there are also adults that play at the same time. And it's very easy for these kids to end up in conversations with people that want to try and take over computers, take over accounts, things like that. And like I said, we do what we can on our back end to limit the scope of any damage that might occur to minors. Parents are really responsible in a lot of cases. I've seen children that will meet people who pretend to be friends, will get them logged into Discord servers, get them to download plugins for games that kind of bypass the, you know, the little Windows warning that pops up, or the Azure warning that says, hey, this plugin's trying to access your account information. Are you sure you want to do that? Well, I'll tell you, an 8-year-old child doesn't know how to answer that question. And sadly, I'm not sure a lot of parents do either. And so from a Microsoft gaming perspective, we've taken it on ourselves to try and make those messages clear where they're required, or just to lock down the interactions entirely where they're not needed. So protecting kids is huge. It, you know, you want the kids to have a good time. That's what this is all about. It's supposed to be a safe environment to go explore and to adventure and to play with friends that they know and they trust. Every once in a while, you get one of these people that slip through and really put the minors at risk. And I can't tell you the response to that is huge, because I think most of the people that work in Microsoft gaming have children of their own or grandkids, right? Like, I now have grandkids and I have concerns. And so there's a huge response when those kinds of things pop up. And so I think we probably see our largest forward momentum when kids are at risk, right? We see those things. We have very difficult conversations. People get very creative, and we come up with some great solutions to protect the kids that are playing the games.
It's interesting you should bring that up, Russ. I mean, what makes this interesting, this area interesting, you know, policies and legal issues aside, is that there's such a huge social engineering aspect to it with a vulnerable class of people. So it leads to very difficult problems, and I do not envy the people that have to work on that on the Microsoft gaming platforms, or any platform for that matter.
Yeah, no, it's challenging, but we love the work we're doing, right? We really do. You get into gaming because you love gaming. Most of the people I know that are in Microsoft gaming didn't just land here by accident. Most of them had a very dedicated path to get here, so it means something to them. And so, you know, I remember being a kid. I remember playing Nintendo. I had an Atari 2600. And, you know, for me, I think of my kids and my grandkids playing those games. It's the same experience, and I want to protect that for them.
So, Russ, I think something that we always ask our guests is two questions, which is, what does a typical day in your life look like? I know that most of the people we ask this question to don't really have a typical day, but we'll try you anyway. And then also, if you had a final thought to leave our listeners with, what would it be?
So a typical day in the life of Russ Rogers at Microsoft Gaming is a lot of phone calls, a lot of conference calls, I would say, usually about security configurations, software development lifecycle. We have conversations about, like I said, incidents related to cheating or bugs or vulnerabilities, things like that. It's probably pretty close to what you would find at any other organization where they develop software that goes out to a wide population, right? And so I don't know that anything other than psychology makes it any more interesting to me. The fact that these are video games we're talking about, right? And that the people are there to have a good time and we want them to have a good time, and we want to protect them while they're doing it. So pretty standard day in the life. I can't say it's super exciting, but I love my job. I love what I do. The advice I would give to people is, you know, this is gaming. Try to enjoy it. Try to be good to one another. Try to help other people enjoy it. I think one of the things that made Minecraft, and I'll go back to Minecraft because it's so impactful. One of the things that made Minecraft so popular is it was just a joyful game. You get on there, it's ridiculous. It's fun. It doesn't hurt anybody. People can get on there and play together and build just fantastic things in the world. The limit is truly your imagination. And I don't think it makes much sense to get in there and try and ruin it for other people. And so that's probably the biggest piece of advice I would give people is just go out and enjoy the games. And if you're interested in gaming and you're interested in security, there obviously is a path for you to get to that. I'm proof of that, living proof of that, even at my ripe old age at this point. So I never let your dreams die. You know, keep pursuing it. Give it a shot. You know, there are a lot of really passionate, loving, caring people that love gaming, but also love security that work in Microsoft. So,
yeah, I want to add to that. And I really don't want to add to your final thought because I've never done it before, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's like in multiplayer games with, you know, that have chat, just respect the people at the other end. Don't start cussing them out. Don't start saying stupid things. You know, you may get banned. I mean, it's not nice. It's not clever. People just get really angry with it. It ruins the gaming experience, to your point. So just, you know, just be kind to, you know, the other human beings who are playing the game along with you. Even if someone stabs you in the back in Battlefield, you know, it's like, hey, just, it is what it is. It's part of the gaming experience. All right. So with that, let's bring this episode to an end. Russ, thank you so much for joining us this week. I could easily, honestly, have gone on for another hour. I love this topic so much. So perhaps we should actually get you on at another point in time and let's discuss other topics in gaming. All right. So let's bring it to an end. As I mentioned, again, Russ, thank you so much for joining us this week. And to all our listeners out there, we hope you found this episode interesting. Again, it was a little bit different. And if you want to see different topics like this, let us know. We're more than happy to talk about absolutely anything security related. So stay safe and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Azure Security Podcast. You can find show notes and other resources at our website, azsecuritypodcast.net. If you have any questions, please find us on Twitter at AzureSecPod. Background music is from ccmixter.com and licensed under the Creative Commons license.